The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated July 24, 2023. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time in large block capital print letters is in a white superimposed upon grayish white clouds with a bit of blue shining through the clouds in the background. Foreground photo, grass. It looks like it may be some type of ground crop, but from here it looks like green grass. Mid foreground buildings. They look a bit run down. There's a bright red roof on a two-story building that looks like it has rust or some type of discoloration streaking from the roof downward. There are some shorter, smaller outbuildings, a total of four seen in the photo. There are trees in the background, a few palms, mostly deciduous trees, power lines, so apparently there is electricity running to this place in the green grassy looking field. Blue skies in the background right behind the buildings, and then rising to clouds, gray white clouds with just a bit of blue poking through. Up at the top right corner of the cover is our 100th year little thumbprint area for turning the page to the inside and beginning then with the view. Subtitled Supreme Court, What the Court Can't Do, by Olatunde Johnson. While a legal blow, the Supreme Court's decision on affirmative action should not and need not be the final word. Our legal and democratic responsibility to address the racial and ethnic inequalities that persist in the U.S. education system is as important as ever, because what the court does not have the power to do is erase our civil rights laws or the principles underlying them. The U.S. Supreme Court just limited the ability of universities to consider an applicant's race and ethnicity in admissions. In its opinion, the court found Harvard and the University of North Carolina's consideration of race and ethnicity in determining admission violated both the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. While Chief Justice Roberts' majority opinion exhibits concern with the pernicious effects of race-conscious affirmative action programs to promote diversity, it ignores the core problem of unjust distribution of educational opportunity and access on the basis of race, ethnicity, and class. Black, Latino, and Vietnamese and Filipino-American communities are among those who remain most underrepresented in higher education, including at selective flagship state institutions in states where they pay taxes. At highly selective public colleges and universities, merit scholarships, out-of-state recruitment practices, and legacy preferences all work to disadvantage underrepresented students of color in admissions, as well as low-income students. Given these inequities, schools and universities still have a legal duty and the opportunity to address them. the same legal statutes and constitutional authority that the Supreme Court majority just invoked to limit race-conscious affirmative action also require educational institutions address underrepresentation within education. The 14th Amendment, drafted by abolitionists inside and outside Congress, aims to grant full citizenship to formerly enslaved people and promote the elimination of racial caste in American democracy. In fact, the court's unanimous 1954 decision in Brown v. Board of Education read the 14th Amendment to forbid state-sponsored segregation in education, recognizing that access to education was necessary for full citizenship for black children. Regardless of the court's recent ruling, Brown creates a duty to advance substantive equality in education and in society. For that reason, the persistence of educational inequities is inconsistent with Brown's principles. Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the statute at issue in the Supreme Court's decision, would soon follow Brown. It forbids discrimination on the basis of race and ethnicity by all entities that take federal funds. This includes public institutions like UNC, as well as private institutions like Harvard. Title VI was enacted to implement Brown's equality and citizenship vision by allowing the federal government to terminate funds to institutions that were not meaningfully integrated. The Civil Rights Act goes on to make clear educational institutions have an affirmative duty to create opportunity. One of the early cases enforcing Title VI in 1974 held that San Francisco school officials had to take affirmative action to provide meaningful access to and funding for bilingual education services for Chinese American students. This case instantiates the core principle that simply refraining from discriminating or offering the same services to all children is not enough to ensure students receive a substantively equal education. A similar duty of affirmative inclusion underlies provisions for students with disabilities in Title IX, which are modeled on Title VI. To advance inclusion, as is still required by our nation's laws, universities will need to examine how their admissions programs and practices continue to disadvantage underrepresented students of color. But this democratic imperative is not just limited to admissions. It is crucial educational institutions create pathways and partnerships that reach underserved students and less resourced schools. This will mean developing programs in elementary and secondary schools, partnerships with community colleges, and transfer policies that enable access to more resourced and selective institutions. Indeed, improving educational access and opportunity is a project for us all. All of us can pay attention to who has access to the colleges and schools that we or our children attend and who does not. The court's opinion cannot stop well-meaning individuals and institutions from caring about racial and ethnic inequality in this country. The Supreme Court has spoken on race-conscious affirmative action for now, but it is not the end of the conversation. It is only the beginning. The author of this article, Johnson, is a professor at Columbia Law School. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, Why a Labour Victory in the UK Could Reset Brexit. If those who staunchly opposed Britain's exit from the European Union win next year's general elections in the UK, might the next British government return to the Union? That is highly unlikely, but there is plenty the two can do to improve their relations. As Keir Starmer leads Britain's Labour Party toward a likely victory next year, ousting the Conservative Party after 14 years in power, Europeans will be watching closely. Starmer not only opposed Brexit in 2016, he also called unsuccessfully for a second referendum in 2019 to overturn the result of the original. The mood in Britain has changed in recent years, as the economic fallout of Brexit has become impossible to ignore. Opinion polls show 56% of British voters now think it was wrong to leave the EU, while only 32% still approve. Starmer's hopeful his party can count on Brexit haters while earning support from pro-Brexit voters fed up with Conservatives and taking back traditional Labour votes in the factory towns of the Northeast and Midlands that Boris Johnson won over in 2019. That is the political logic behind his strategy to publicly reject any move to rejoin the EU and to refuse to accept the free movement of people from EU members. Make Brexit work remains his message. As to what he would do to strengthen the UK-EU ties, the cautious Starmer will remain tight-lipped. Once safely ensconced at 10 Downing Street, however, he will probably move quickly to reset and improve relations, and there is plenty that can be done. His government could rewrite rules to reduce friction on food, agricultural, and medical goods by realigning with EU standards. It could align Britain with professional and product safety standards and kickstart UK-EU trade flows by relaxing rules on the Irish Sea border, a move sure to win praise across Europe. It could also align with the single market without actually rejoining it, accepting some but not all of its obligations. It could rejoin the Horizon Program for research and innovation. A Labour government would also probably sign a new security agreement with the EU that covers defense, energy, and new technologies. Starmer would expect a friendly European response to any proposal to boost ties. In the early days after Britain's vote in for Brexit, European leaders were reluctant to offer the UK any favorable terms for a new relationship for fear of encouraging populists in other EU member states to push for exit referendums of their own. That is hardly a concern these days, given just how far Britain's economy and growth prospects have deteriorated. There are no serious proposals within European countries to follow Britain's lead. A Labour victory next year would open a new chapter in relations with Europe. Turning the page to The View interview, subtitled World, Vladimir Putin's Uncertain Future by Yasmin Serhan. It's an interview. It's an interview style. And there is an editorial remark here that this interview has been edited for style and length. There is a photo here of Mr. Putin as he addresses the nation in Moscow, June 26. It looks almost photoshopped. This gentleman's facial skin is so smooth. It's not quite ruddy, but there is a pinkish hue to it. His hair is neatly combed. He has a receding hairline, and the hair is mostly gray. He is neither smiling nor frowning, but looking quite specific at the camera lens. He wears a dark blue, I would say navy, suit and tie with a white shirt. He's in a darkly paneled room with a flag behind him, but the identification on the flag is not legible because the flag is on a standard. When Vladimir Putin delivered a speech just days after surviving the greatest challenge to his 23 years in power, he sought to strike a defiant tone. The Russian president described the armed convoy of thousands of Russian soldiers led by Wagner Group Chief Yevgeny Prigozhin as a mutiny designed to foment domestic turmoil and its organizers as plotters who betrayed their country. Yet in that June 26 speech, Putin did not reveal plans for punishment or retribution. Putin said Prigozhin and his men would be free to go into exile in Belarus, Russia's vassal state next door. This is not the traditional Putin playbook, according to Bill Browder, who would know better than most. The London-based financier has spent more than a decade exposing corruption and human rights abuses in Russia. Browder has personally faced the ire of the Kremlin, which declared him a threat to Russian national security in 2005, and he's seen friends and colleagues jailed and even killed for their activism. One such friend, the prominent Russian journalist and Putin critic, Vladimir Karamurza, was sentenced in April to 25 years on charges of treason. Speaking to Time by phone the day after Putin's address to his country, Browder discussed the aftermath of the failed Wagner rebellion and the future of the man who has led Russia longer than anyone else since Joseph Stalin. Following are five questions and answers. Question. Prigozhin was able to get within 124 miles of Moscow before his forces turned around. Is Putin the omnipotent autocrat observers believed he was? Answer. Again, these answers are by Browder. Yes, Browder. What's his first name? Bill Browder, the London-based financier. Putin has tried to create this image of a strong man in total control, and there's really been no way to test that from outside Russia because opinion polls are completely meaningless. And then all of a sudden, June 24, we see a relatively small group of armed marauders cross into Russian territory, totally unopposed, go into Rostov-on-Don, and take control of one of the most important military bases in the country. That just shows the image that Putin has been trying to project is a complete fraud. As Prigozhin made his way toward Voronezh, the same thing happened there. Then he got on the highway to Moscow. The only reason why he did not complete his journey was that 8,000 men cannot take over a country of 141 million people unless they have co-conspirators. And I believe he probably thought he did, and it was probably prearranged, and those people got cold feet when the situation escalated to that point. This is a monumental challenge to Putin. Unless he's able to reassert the impression that he's this ruthless strongman, he will lose his power and lose his life. Question. Putin let Prigozhin go, despite having done far worse to critics who have done far less. Why do you think that is? Again, Bill Browder. Putin jailed Vladimir Karamurza 25 years for giving a few speeches about rights abuses. To have an actual rebellious traitor and to let him off is completely out of character. Why would Putin be so lenient? Well, there are two reasons. One is that Prigozhin is the most capable fighter in all of Russia. He is a killer. He is ruthless. He has every capacity to cause unheard-of hardships for Putin and people around him. Putin should be as afraid of Prigozhin as Prigozhin should be of Putin. The second reason is that Prigozhin continues to be a key man in Russia. Russia is so full of incompetency that the one person who emerged who was competent at military operations was Yevgeny Prigozhin. He was the one person the Ukrainians respected on the battlefield, and he runs 17 other military operations in Africa. So Prigozhin is both too ruthless to arrest and also too important to the overall foreign policy of Russia. Question: how has the rebellion undermined Putin's image within Russia? Answer: his image has been totally destroyed. Russia's like a prison yard. Putin was able to establish himself as chief criminal in the prison yard by being so ruthless at the very beginning of his presidency, and that ruthlessness and that brutality allowed him to stay in power in a country in which it is very difficult to do that. The fact he was rumored to have gotten on his plane and fled Moscow, the fact that Prigozhin was unopposed, the fact that he let Prigozhin off the hook afterwards, it makes Putin look like a truly weak leader in a country where weakness is despised. There's no way this won't invite more challenges now because Putin's strength is diminished. Question: with all that in mind, what do you think the future holds for Putin? Answer: the door has now been open for anyone to challenge Putin. If somebody can step into his shoes at some point, the riches are beyond imagination. So there is a huge incentive for people to do that. Putin still has an opportunity to redeem himself, but in doing so, he's going to have to embark on an almighty purge that we have not seen since Stalin's time. And I think that that is what he's going to do, but whether he succeeds is another question. Final question: Prigozhin went to Belarus under the terms of the deal that prompted him to turn his march on Moscow around. Will he be safe there? Answer: everyone's talking about Prigozhin needing to worry. I think Putin probably needs to worry more about Prigozhin than vice versa. Prigozhin's a trained, cold-blooded killer. Putin is a guy who hides in his bunker. Turning now to the Time Off section, Time Off Television. This is an essay, How Political Thrillers Lost the Plot, by Judy Berman. The latest Marvel TV series, Secret Invasion, opens with an uncharacteristically timely monologue. Imagine a world where information cannot be trusted, rasps a CIA agent in present-day Moscow. Not very hard, is it? News service says one thing. Website says another. Society starts to fray. All we can turn to are the people we care about. But what if those people weren't who we thought they were? So far, so chillingly authentic to this era of information bubbles and conspiracy thinking. But then Agent Prescott Richard Dormer continues, what if they weren't even human? It turns out he's talking about Skrulls, S-K-R-U-L-L-S, reptilian space aliens who hide behind human faces on Earth. According to his theory, a different group of militants are really all part of the Skrulls' plot to overthrow humanity. It is a shrewd setup, familiar enough to resonate in the real, chaotic world of 2023, but vague enough to be universally palatable. Depending on your perspective, the Skrulls could be the lizard people of proto-QAnon conspiracy theories or Russian intelligence operatives undermining democracy. This slippery approach to political subtext is nothing new for Disney-owned Marvel, which is constantly recalibrating its family-friendly superheroes for a time when extreme partisanism can render even the most anodyne entertainment controversial, and when Hollywood products must satisfy the conflicting mores of the many nations that import them. What's notable about Secret Invasion, styled as a Cold War spy thriller, but abstracted from the ideological conflicts of the real Cold War, is how common its particular form of evasiveness has become among TV's most popular thrillers. shows set within the crucible of politics suddenly seem allergic to political ideas of all kinds. Often the result is thematic incoherence, so conspicuous it makes suspension of disbelief impossible. Series as technically polished at Netflix as Netflix's hit Carrie Russell vehicle The Diplomat and Amazon's Russo Brothers franchise Citadel hang on eye-poppingly absurd premises. Yet behind these screens that streamers have left blank for members of enormous global audiences to project their own diverse values, a political perspective both cynical in its opaqueness and aspirational in its simplicity is taking shape. The Apple TV Plus miniseries Hijack, a real-time thriller in the tradition of 24, unfolds on a 7-hour flight from Dubai to London. Idris Elba stars as a passenger who happens to be a preternaturally calm corporate negotiator who has shepherded clients through high-stress mergers and takeovers. So he is uniquely prepared to influence the hijackers toward his preferred outcome, getting home alive. First, he has to figure out who they are and what they want. The history of airplane hijacking is a history of political outrage taken to brutal extremes. Blockbuster thrillers from Air Force One to Die Hard 2 have mirrored this theme. Hijack, brace for a mild spoiler, is different. After a bit of misdirection involving a hijacker who speaks Arabic and is thus presumed by two oafish passengers to be a suicide bomber, it becomes clear that these attackers have no political agenda. The motivation behind their crime is so complex and unlikely as to verge on nonsensical. You can see why its creators would avoid political subtext. Post 9/11 thrillers like 24 and Homeland notoriously fed Islamophobia. The right's peculiar sensitivities dictate Putin's Russia is no longer a universally acknowledged foe. Meanwhile, Apple TV Plus is, like Netflix, Prime Video et al., available in more than 100 countries. There's no way for a show designed for broad international appeal to parse the politics of real state violence and terrorism without alienating audiences crucial to its success. Recent thrillers set squarely in the realm of global politics have contorted their storylines in even sillier ways, presumably for similar reasons. The Diplomat casts Russell as a career Foreign Service officer, suddenly appointed as the American ambassador to the UK, just after a deadly attack on a British aircraft carrier. The show teases the usual suspects, Iran, Russia, before settling on a patently ridiculous culprit closer to home. The moral of the story? Diplomacy is good. It's a takeaway so innocuous you'd have to be a militant extremist or a war profiteer to disagree. Dopier still is Citadel, an expensive espionage thriller Amazon is spinning off into a multilingual franchise. The plot circles around the question of which of two ex-lover agents, Priyanka Chopra and Richard Madden, sabotage the show's eponymous top-secret organization, an international group described as being loyal only to the safety and security of all people. Citadel watched the Watchers, preventing nuclear launches and Y2K crises, before its annihilation by Manticore, an also blandly international crime syndicate. It was the last line of defense for good in the world. It is possible to make a substantive thriller without explicitly addressing any real-world political situation. See TNT's The Lazarus Project. What is disconcerting about this new crop of shows is that their studied neutrality extends to abstract ideals like freedom and safety. Cold War thrillers tended to champion capitalist individualism over authoritarian communism. Post-Watergate conspiracy thrillers, from The Parallax View to 3 Days of the Condor, caution viewers to question authority at home. But their contemporary counterparts are so timid, they have reduced a supposedly grown-up genre to so many superhero stories awash in truisms. The bad guys are bad because they're criminals. The good guys are good because they're the good guys. The irony is that as much as we might look to entertainment to escape from the world's endless problems, no form of pop culture storytelling can ever be truly apolitical. These thrillers' rejection of not just current events, but also the conflicting ideas and values that underlie them, is itself political. It reveals the widening gulf that separates viewers both at home and abroad, and it speaks to our collective exhaustion with politicized discourse. In tiptoeing around such extreme sensitivities, TV's new thrillers end up inhabiting moral universes where characters bereft of personal convictions about things like justice or the common good can only make selfish decisions. Elba's Sam, whose choice of career suggests a ruthless pursuit of self-interest, is up front with the hijackers. He does not want to be a hero. He just wants to get home to the people he loves. By the end of its first season, Citadel devolves into a sort of high-octane family drama propelled by passion, betrayal, trauma, that all-purpose plot driver, rather than by any deeper understanding of what its clash of titans means for the world. It is all pretty cynical and accidentally reflective of a public sphere where any expression of belief or concern is likely to be dismissed as virtue signaling. Yet the flip side to the glibness of these shows is their sincere longing for simplicity amid the complexities of a world filled with tribes of adherents to mutually exclusive dogmas, each certain that they are right. As bland as the diplomat's defense of diplomacy is, it is also soothing. 16 months into Russia's war on Ukraine, as refugees stream out of Syria and South Sudan, to imagine an elite corps of public servants competently nipping international incidents in the bud. What is Citadel but an imaginary representation of the same fantasy? There is nothing more quintessentially human than the wish for perfect knowledge of right and wrong. It is the foundation of religion. The Deus Ex Machina has been a narrative device since ancient Greece. Now we call those characters superheroes, and they do not wait till the end of the story to show up with a moral judgment, but superhero tales are simplistic for a reason. They were conceived for children. In a more sophisticated world, where the so-called bad guys are the people whose claim on Earth is just as legitimate as our own, not space aliens looking to displace the whole lot of us. The only honest way to separate good from evil is to define those terms. Time off movies. Sisterhood of the Traveling Raunch by Laura Zornosa. Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion got back to Joyride director Adele Lim, that's L-I-M, faster than she thought possible. Yes, she had permission to include their song WAP in her directorial debut. To set the scene, the summer comedy's four protagonists are stuck in China, trying to get to South Korea, despite having had their passports stolen. They need a big shiny distraction, so naturally they disguise themselves as the brand new fictional K-pop group Brownie Tuesday and launch into a yassified version of the sexually explicit modern rap classic. It is a larger-than-life scene that gets its last laugh from a flash of female frontal nudity, a rarity in film, but especially in the context of the genre. Dicks have always been comedy somehow, says the film's co-writer, Teresa Hsiao. Jason Segel whips it out in Forgetting Sarah Marshall and You Laugh, but women's anatomy has always been sexualized, and we can take that back, too. This can also be funny. Our parts are not always just there to be sexy. WAP, W-A-P, all in caps, is a microcosm of the themes of the movie, which premiered to raves at SXSW in March and hit the theaters July 7. It rolls a message of female empowerment and owning one's sexuality into something else. For the song, that something is rap lyrics and splashy visuals. For the movie, it is messy comedy and raw raunch. Joyride is deliciously filthy, but buried beneath the dirty jokes is a genuine story of identity and friendship. The movie follows Audrey, Emily in Paris's Ashley Park, back to her motherland China, on a business trip to close a critical deal. Her childhood friend, Lolo, Good Trouble's Sherry Cola, tags along to translate. Lolo's cousin, Deadeye, stand-up comic Sabrina Wu, joins in to meet up with their online K-pop friends. And Audrey's college friend, soap opera star Cat, Everything Everywhere All at Once breakout Stephanie Hsu, loves a grand adventure. The medium is the message, says Lim, who also co-wrote Crazy Rich Asians and Raya and the Lost Dragon. We do not have to talk about cultural relevance and representation in Asian female sexuality. We just have the faces of our leads on screen, and that does a lot. This summer, between Joyride, the Jennifer Lawrence vehicle No Hard Feelings, and Bottoms from Shiva Baby duo Emma Seligman and Rachel Sennett, the body flavor of the 2010s is back, but this time its weight has shifted toward authenticity. What comedy does is you can present something that's actually stealthily profound and moving without leading with it, Lim says, and sometimes that's more effective, reaching people when they least expect it. Joyride is a search for belonging, both culturally and within friendships and family. Audrey was adopted by a white couple and is not particularly connected to her heritage. If you do not know where you come from, asks her Chinese business partner, played by Ronnie Cheng, how do you know who you are? And so begins an epic quest to find Audrey's birth mom, ostensibly to appease the business partner and close the deal, but unsurprisingly holding the potential for much deeper revelations. Hijinks ensue. The WAP production, a run-in with a drug dealer, a sex scene that results in multiple injuries. Lim, Hsiao, and Hsiao's co-writer, Cherry Chevapravadumrong, I'll spell that, Chevapravadumrong, drew from comedic and ensemble influences like The Hangover, Bridesmaids, and Girls Trip. Those films had the tone and the joyful abandon we wanted that was just unapologetic, Lim says. We're not going to water things down. We're not going to lean into what we find funny, because that's going to be the magic stickiness to it. Hsiao and Chevapravadumrong met around 2012 when they were both working on Family Guy. Since then, they've also worked together on Hsiao's Comedy Central show, Awkwafina is Nora from Queens. In conversation, they crack deadpan jokes, commit to bits, and egg each other on. Both of them, like Audrey and Lolo, grew up in towns that were predominantly white. Also, as with Audrey and Lolo, there was only one other Asian girl in Hsiao's hometown, and they became fast friends. In time, the co-writers met Lim and began meeting at her house Thursday nights. It was around 2018 they started throwing plot points on cheap CVS whiteboards. No idea, not even a stunt sequence involving a water buffalo crossing a river, was too wild. Though some, as in the case of the water buffalo, proved too expensive. They were writing a movie for fun, the kind they would have wanted to watch growing up. Lim grew up in Malaysia, watching Stephen Chow comedies and Hong Kong action movies. The inappropriate messiness of Joyride was there, she says, but when she got to the U.S., she observed a whole different perception of Asians. Asian women in particular were fetishized on screen. Sexy assassin, femme fatale, human trafficking victim. Joyride eschews the male gaze. Its jokes are from female and non-binary perspectives. All of it's through a lens of our characters taking the power into their own hands, Sheba Pravat Dumrong says. While the sex scene sequence is chaotic and side-splitting on screen, on set it was taken seriously, and each actor worked with an intimacy coordinator. There is a lot of storytelling that really puts women's sexuality in a box. From Disney princess narratives or even K-dramas, where the woman's about denying your sexuality and having a guy ease it out of you or take it by force, Lim says. The solution to that, she says, is to have a space for us to discover our own sexuality, completely separate of the male point of view. Without, frankly, and perhaps this is above all else the point, giving A-S-H space T about their point of view. This page is headed by 8 questions. Andrew Huberman, the Stanford University neuroscientist, on his wildly popular podcast, Seductive Biology and the Real Meaning of Optimization. This is by Jamie Ducharme. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Huh, it says 8 questions. I'm counting 10. Let me count again. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Yep. There's a photo here. It's in black and white. It's of a man. We see a shoulder shot of him. He's wearing a dark-colored shirt, maybe black, but it's a black and white photo. He has dark, closely cropped hair and neatly trimmed dark facial hair, and he's grinning at the camera. And this is a question and answer format. Question, did you always want to be a scientist? Answer, if you've met me at 15, I would have had dyed black hair, skateboarding on the stairs over there. I barely finished high school. When I finally discovered science, it was like, whoa. I remember thinking in graduate school, I can't believe this. There's so much to figure out. Question, you get tons of people to listen to an hours-long science podcast. How? Answer, I like to think it's because people are curious and they want to learn. This sounds a little sentimental, but I think biology is beautiful. As biological creatures, we are captivated by biology. There's a very seductive aspect to our own biology and the things we see around us. Question. Huberman Lab has taken off as general trust in scientists has gone down. Why do you think that is? Answer. You'd have to ask some of the listeners, but if I were to venture a guess, I talk directly to people. They get to hear not just the sound bite or the news reel, but what excites or concerns me about something, my own experience with things, my own observations. There's more of a contextual basis that gives trust. Question, how much of the podcast's appeal is about life optimization, to borrow a word you sometimes use? Answer, I never thought optimization was such a dirty word until I said it. Optimization tends to rub people the wrong way. For some people, it implies there's a best way to live, and anything less than that or different than that is no good, and that certainly is not what we mean. Optimization, to me, is a verb. It is a process by which you are trying to improve something by organizing variables in a very controlled way. You hear a lot that we all want a pill. We want a one-size-fits-all. We want to fix it overnight. To me, optimization is the antithesis of that. Question. I do not understand how you fit everything you do. Teaching at Stanford, research, the podcast, working on a book into your schedule. Answer. Well, that wasn't really a question, but here's the answer. I am not superhuman. I do not take any magic supplement that allows all that to happen. It is incredible how much you can do if you're operating around 80% to 100% mental and physical capacity. It is amazing how hard it is to stay at that capacity, but it is also amazing how easy it is to return to that capacity if you insert true rest in between. Question, do you ever just eat dessert and not work out and forget about your health protocols? Answer, sure, I love dessert, but for me the food vices are pizza, any bread and butter combination, and croissants. Question, what do you do for fun? Answer, I learn, and I like to exercise, but sometimes it's just a hike, it's just walking, it's just thinking. I love music, I like creative people. I do work a lot, but I also try to see friends and socialize. Question, I get the sense that you love science, and you love to teach, but you do not necessarily love being a famous person. Answer, which is, again, not to a question. Even those words make me feel a little bit uncomfortable. Question, so do you ever think about ending the podcast and just teaching? Answer, no, it is a compulsion for me to learn and to teach. I have every intention of continuing the podcast because I can teach far more people that way than I can in the classroom. But in 3 or 4 or 5 years, if we're not being effective with what we're trying to do, who knows, maybe I'll run for office. Question, would you really? Answer, the problem is I do not like meetings. I do not like being indoors too much, but here is the thing. I do not know if this is good or not, but more than I care about me, I care about the goal. It would have to be not about what I want. It would have to be my body is a vehicle to accomplish a specific set of things I feel I need to do and that the world needs. And that article really did encompass just 8 questions, but there were 2 more paragraphs. What is Ode? How the tiny island of Barbados became a leader in the global push for reparations, by Janelle Ross, Bridgetown, Barbados, with reporting by Simone Shaw and Julia Zorthian. This is a lengthy article, so it may be a bridge. When we reached the dirt road leading to Drax Hall Plantation, Esther Phillips suggests we stop the car. Phillips, 73, gets out and draws in a deep breath. There's a faint, sweet smell of something akin to rum out here, about 8 miles from the capital city. The dried remains of sugar cane, burned, then harvested, flank the road. This is about as close as she can get. Drax Hall, D-R-A-X space, H-A-L-L, a Barbados plantation where sugar's been reaped for nearly 4 centuries, was for so long just an ordinary part of what Phillips understood as her wholesome childhood. She grew up nearby, skipping across the grounds to school. She remembers gathering milk from cows here, hearing stories about a relative working in the big house, caring for the child referred to as the young Missy. She remembers her grandfather overseeing a crew of women in the plantation's Negro, or another N-word, yard. Built in the early 1650s, Drax Hall is believed to be the oldest Jacobean structure in the Western Hemisphere. It's here that enslaved black labor and later people existing somewhere between slavery and freedom did the dangerous work to make others sugar rich. But Phillips, the island's first poet laureate, now describes herself as persona non grata here, something she came to believe after a conversation with a staff member when she called to request access. Road signs describing the property as private appeared around that time, too, she says. Her apparent offense in late 2021, with part of the hall in the frame, Phillips read from what she calls her plantation poems for a British TV crew. In spare, evocative language, they explore Phillips' dawning factual and emotional understanding. Drax Hall, which now belongs to Richard Drax, a conservative member of the British Parliament and part of an unbroken family line of Drax Hall heirs, was the site of untold horrors. Her island home is a place where mass production with enslaved labor was so optimized for profit that the brutal local way was exported to other colonies. Like Phillips, people here and all over this region have become increasingly insistent that apologies with meaningful recompense are overdue. The idea that people held captive and robbed of their labor are owed reparations has been discussed by enslaved people for centuries. It shows up in 17th century Barbados court cases filed by the few who wrestled their way to freedom, says Sir Hilary Beckles, a Barbados-born historian and author of Britain's Black Debt. The idea also occupies space in a 1775 essay by the colonial American political theorist Thomas Paine. More recently, reparation supporters have pushed past mere debate. In the U.S., two federal reparations bills have stalled. States, cities, and institutions have taken steps on the issue, though even these relatively small-scale programs have often been met with outrage and disdain. In 2021, Evanston, Illinois moved first, launching a $10 million reparations program. Phase one, a lottery, aiming to give about 16 black families home ownership assistance of up to $25,000 each, less than 10% of the city's median home value. That generated significant misinformation and complaints of racial discrimination against non-black residents. A San Francisco committee released a proposal in January calling for lump sum payments of $5 million to eligible individuals, spurring instant backlash. Since May, a statewide California task force has made it public its own reparations recommendations, 40 chapters of research on resolving vast inequality, while the New Jersey Institute for Social Justice has launched a council to conduct a study of the impacts of slavery, and New York lawmakers have approved something similar. Elsewhere, the Netherlands has apologized for its role in the slave trade. The Church of England has identified ways one of its arms profited from enslavement and set aside a £100 million, $127.63 million fund to address racial inequality. The new King of England has agreed to a study of the monarchy's already documented ties to the slave trade, though the nation's new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, the first Indian-British person in that role, has rejected calls for reparations. On Barbados, reparations have moved from a fringe idea to a thing everyone's talking about. And this island, long regarded, some would say intentionally misconstrued, as so compliant with the colonial project that it's sometimes called Little Britain, has moved into a regional leadership position. Barbados is that country, says Doreen Omard, chairman of the Antigua and Barbuda Reparation Support Commission and Vice Chair of the Regional CARICOM Reparations Commission. CARICOM, or the Caribbean Community, is an intergovernment organization with 15 member and 5 affiliated states. CARICOM, CARICOM's Prime Ministerial Subcommittee on Reparations for Native Genocide and Slavery, 5 elected officials led by Barbados Prime Minister Mia Mottley, is expected this year to request that 10 European countries begin negotiations for reparations. Almost a decade ago, CARICOM's Reparations Commission developed a 10-point plan, calling for, among other things, a careful accounting of what occurred, formal apologies, attention to the psychological and cultural toll of centuries of oppression, European funding to strengthen infrastructure, education, and health care, and debt forgiveness. European countries rebuffed this request, but an updated 10-point plan will be finalized in the next few months, Omard says. This year's demand for reparations, which will call for a Marshall Plan-like public investment, not the individual payments that have dominated the conversation elsewhere, will arrive with more force. African countries, about 2 decades after they were first asked, have agreed to support the claim, and CARICOM officials have built alliances with reparations activists in the U.S. The letters are expected to say the time has come to negotiate reparations to improve infrastructure and human conditions in the Caribbean. Come to the table, they will say, or prepare to see much of the Caribbean in international court. That article was considerably abridged because we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.